Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the show. As we're closing out this month, would love to do the shout out to the Realignment's Supercast. It's how we fund the show, and it's how I'm going to start doing these in-person recordings in Austin, really building out our studio and actual efforts there. I'm incredibly excited. We've got some great guests coming down the pipe. If you'd like to get access to the Q&A that's coming out tomorrow, submit your own questions, and of course, once again, support the show as we continue to scale. We'd love if you go to realignment.supercast.com. Once again, that's realignment.supercast.com. Today's episode is definitely going to be near and dear to Realignment listeners' hearts. We are focusing on the question of why have Hispanic / Latino voters increasingly been voting Republican, despite the obvious headwinds that would make that seem a surprising fact, especially if you're my age, really looking at politics through the lens of 2013, when the Republican Party thought the only way you could do better for Hispanics would be to, let's say, do immigration reform, provide a pathway to citizenships. All those very clear policy ideas that President Trump's nomination in 2016 clearly didn't support. So why, given the fact that we did not take that other door, has the Republican Party increasingly been improving its percentages and performances in the Hispanic community? To help answer some of these questions, I'm speaking with Gerardo Cadava about his book, The Hispanic Republican. If you want to check out this book, it's available in our bookshop or it can be purchased anywhere else. All that said, once again, great episode. As we get closer to the election season, looking forward to doing more of these realignment-themed episodes. Hope you all enjoy this conversation. Gerardo Cadava, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you so much for having me, Marshall.
Really glad to speak with you. I wanted to do an episode on the topic of Hispanic / Latino voters forever, because it's definitely one that, as the zeitgeist on this issue has changed, has gotten really discombobulated. So I want to center things for folks. Let me start with this question. I was reading a book recently for review purposes, and I noticed a slightly funny editing error. In one paragraph, you have the author refer to Latinos, Hispanics, and then Latinx people. And I genuinely think what's happened here is that the editor hasn't decided what is used in what context. So without any judgments on any terms, can you just actually define what these three terms are? Because your book is The Hispanic Republican, but you've written pieces at The Atlantic where it's called The Latino Vote. So how should we understand these terms?
And I personally might not be as doctrinaire about these things as other people. So I myself am comfortable moving in and out of Hispanic, Latino, Latinx, depending on what audience I'm talking to. So basically, Hispanic is a term that was kind of popularized in the 1970s, maybe early 1980s. That might have been the most prevalent term at the time. It's often noted that it was a kind of creation of the Nixon administration for the first time, and used for the first time in the 1970s census when Hispanics were referred to as Hispanics. I think in the years since, it's come to have a particular political connotation, especially among conservatives. Like, the earliest advocacy groups for Hispanic Republicans, one was called the Republican National Hispanic Assembly. Many Latino conservatives refer to themselves as Hispanics. It's also really regional. New Mexicans still tend to use the term a lot. Puerto Ricans on the island of Puerto Rico still tend to use the term a lot. And I do think it connotes a relationship with Spain and the Spanish Empire, Hispanic. And so depending on your perspective, that can be either distasteful or something to celebrate. Latino is kind of more pan-Latin American, I guess. And, you know, the debates among Latinos about where to draw the boundaries around Latinidad, Brazil is a good example. Like, if Latinos are united by the Spanish language, then there's not much room for Brazil. But if Latino refers to Latin American, presumably that would include Brazilians as well. These are the kind of contours of the debate. And Latinx is a much more recent term that is meant to be gender inclusive. You know, Spanish is a language where you can say Latina to refer to women, Latino to refer to men. And so youngsters in general, I can't believe I just said youngsters. I feel like that makes me an old man almost. But youth, students I teach, have embraced the term Latinx to be more gender inclusive. In my book, I used the Hispanic Republican because that was the preferred term for the characters I was writing about.
And what happened to the term Chicano? I've like noticed like when you read, like, I'm thinking back to like my undergrad days, like in academic books, especially they're referred to Chicano. Like what happened with that term?
It's still around. It's still around. You can find people on Twitter in their handle describing themselves as Chicanos. I think there's also variations of that. Like some people say, I spell Chicano with an X and it's spelled X-I-C-A-N-O. And that's more of an indigenous spelling of Chicano. So, and these two have cultural and political meaning, I think. So Chicano is still around. I think it for sure, it specifically applies to Mexican Americans. And I think the people you would find using it today live primarily in the Southwest.
So here's a question then that I think is slightly uncomfortable, but I'll ask it anyways. Mm-hmm. To what degree does the culture war naming controversy actually matter when it comes to talking about the phenomenon we're discussing today, which is like the Hispanic Latino conservative? So for example, if you talk about how Republicans are making inroads in Texas, is that because Democrats are out of touch and say Latinx? And when we say Democrats are out of touch, we really mean people in Brooklyn, if we're like honest about what how much does that debate tend to matter in these actual communities?
I think that's a terrific question. It's hard to pinpoint, you know. I mean, I do think Latinx, for those who are inclined to oppose the usage of the term, who do not like the term, I think they lump Latinx in with a whole bunch of other issues like defund the police, abolish ICE. It's just another symbol of the times in terms of how the woke left is driving the train off the rails, you know? I think that's what it symbolizes. On the other hand, for the people who use it, I think it really is meant to be an inclusive, all-encompassing term. I remember reading a book by Paula Ramos called Finding Latinx. That's a real strong argument for how Latinx is an inclusive term, even for those who don't identify as Latinx. It's meant to be inclusive. I think those are the kind of contours of the debate. I don't personally understand how people can get so fired up about naming preferences. I mean, on the one hand, I feel like today we live in a country where everyone is allowed to define their own identity for themselves. You know, you have the use of gender pronouns in classrooms and many other settings. So we're comfortable with this idea that our identities are individually defined. So for me, if someone wants to call themselves Latinx, they should call themselves Latinx. I have no problem with that. I don't think that it's a term that people should impose on other people, but I also don't think it's a term that, you know, someone should get so fired up about that it also defines their sense of politics. I mean, to me, people call themselves what they want to call themselves. I am happy to call someone else the thing that they want to be called. So, you know, that's how I feel about it. I should say, you know, I'm sitting in a particular context as the director of a Latina and Latino Studies program at Northwestern University. We are called the Latina and Latino Studies program. Our students a few years ago wanted us to change the name of our program to the Latinx Studies program. And for various reasons, you know, it's interestingly, the administration hopped on it. They were excited to use Latinx Studies, maybe because it's shorter, it's easier to spell, who knows. But faculty were more ambivalent, not necessarily because they were ideologically opposed, but because if you know anything about Latino naming practices over a long period of time, you know that what's fashionable kind of changes all the time. It goes from Spanish speaking to Hispanic to American of Mexican descent to Chicano to Latino and Latino. So if we're changing the name of our program to always keep up with what's current, we're going to be changing the name of our program every 5 years, you know? So I think this gets another added layer of complexity when you think about publishing and in-house style guides. You know, I get emails from newspaper publications all the time that say, you know, can you guide us on what term we should use? And I think that, you know, I guess I'll give the advice now to whoever's listening that I think Latino is safe. I think Hispanic is safe. I myself use Latino, and but you know, I'm a 44-year-old man, and maybe that says more about what generation I come from than anything else. So I think Hispanic and Latino are still pretty safe.
Yeah. Last one on this note before we get to a couple other topics. What I wonder about when you're talking about your students, so, you know, younger students are interested in, you know, changing names, those different bits. I wonder about how like class plays into that, in the sense that, you know, Northwestern, it's an excellent school. I've lived with a bunch of my roommates went to Northwestern, could entirely vouch on y'all's programs, obviously, aside from rankings and everything. But, you know, that's a specific portion of like the like Latino population that is going to a place like Northwestern, that is going to work at those newspapers, that is going at those places, New York Times, Style Guides, all those different bits. So how should we think about how a community uses terms when who gets to set the rules of what terms are used, especially in today's culturally polarized America, are clearly not, it's, this clearly isn't democratic. Whether it's right or wrong, this is not like a democratic process.
I might need to know a little bit more about what you mean, but let me try to answer it. And then if I'm kind of going off track, you can bring me back. But, you know, I think that it's a really interesting question, you know, what the kind of class dynamic and social class and, you know, educational background is of people who use Latinx or Latino or Hispanic. Like I said already that, you know, a term like Hispanic tends to be used regionally as well in a place like New Mexico. So even places like Northwestern, I mean, Latino students from New Mexico might come to Northwestern thinking of themselves as Hispanic and are only confronted with the term Latina or Latino or Latinx for the first time when they come to Northwestern, regardless of what their political background is or what their national background is. But I also don't know if, you know, there's a higher prevalence of the use of a word like Latinx in a place like Los Angeles or Chicago than a place like Florida, where, you know, there are also students at Northwestern. Many of the students I meet at Northwestern who are from Miami, for example, are Latinas who went to a school in Miami called the Carrollton School of the Sacred Heart, which is almost entirely Latino and Latin American. Many Latin Americans send their children to the Carrollton School of the Sacred Heart. And I've never heard them call themselves Latinx. But the other thing that happens, I think, when you get to college is that, you know, you meet people from places that are not the place that you came from, and you kind of develop your own new ideas about identity and your relationship to a community. So it would be an interesting thing to study to see how people's self-identification and naming practices change once they go to college. I mean, I grew up in Tucson, Arizona, in California. I'm the product of a, you know, white mother and a Latino father. And by Latino father, I mean like Colombian, Panamanian, Filipino, Mexican. And I don't, you know, in the 70s and 80s, I never called myself a Latino. I just don't think that term was in circulation as much. Then we moved to Princeton, New Jersey. I don't even know what I called myself then. But, you know, the first time I started calling myself Latino maybe was in college. So identity is complicated, man. I mean, that's the bottom line. I feel like it changes. Individual people can have, you know, different senses of themselves in one context versus another. And in general, I think my general principle is to kind of let people identify themselves the way that they want to be identified, and don't expect that there's going to be consistency, and people might refer to themselves in different ways in different contexts at different moments in their lives. That becomes hard, of course, when, you know, you're like a political candidate like Elizabeth Warren and your aides are telling you to use the term Latinx, and you think you're doing the right thing because you're following your campaign advisor's advice, but you're walking into a thicket that you don't quite understand, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you actually mostly answered it, but I want to give a little bit more succinct version of it. Basically, what I'm curious about is young Latino students who go to a school like Northwestern, are likely, mm-hmm. not always going to be, are likely to be professional. You're going to go to law school, you're going to med school, all those different bits. You are demographically different than a Hispanic or Latino kid who is from LA and doesn't go on to college. Mm-hmm. When you were referring earlier to the Latinx question, you're like, oh, maybe I'm just like an old guy at 44. Mm-hmm. Well, I would guess there'd probably be a difference in Latinx usage based on whether or not you're going to college or not going to college, is basically what I was getting at. And then I'm just sort of, I'm broadly interested in the topic of like, how do you have conversations about race in institutions when only mm-hmm. certain demographic or ideological aspects of any one group are like represented. So for example, you know, there's been lots of reporting about how the Biden campaign had this difficulty because you had like young Black staffers who thought one view, had one view on questions like race and policing, all those different bits. Those positions didn't quite track with, let's say, the broad opinion of like the Black majority in this country. That's not to say any one side is right on these questions, but it's like a really fascinating dynamic that I don't think anyone's really thought about, because I think we're in this weird position where we want to make race everything about race, and everything kind of is always about race, but there also are class and demographic dynamics that fit into that. And America's always been awkward about that.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. I'm not exactly sure how that maps on to the question of Latinx as a term that gets used. It sounds like, I don't know the answer to this, but it sounds like your assumption might be that college educated Latinos or college students who are Latino would be more likely to use Latinx than, say, someone who doesn't go to college.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, that might be right. I'm not sure. But I also think that if a student doesn't go to a university like Northwestern, it doesn't mean that they don't necessarily go to college either. And this is where I think the regional and local variations come into play. Because if you're a student, for example, from Los Angeles who goes to Cal State LA, I mean, the programs out there are still called Chicano studies programs or Mexican American studies programs. They're not even called Latino studies programs. UCLA recently changed its name to, I can't remember if it used to be called the Chicano Studies Research Center. I don't know if they moved to Latino Studies, but they all certainly incorporated the name Central American Studies into their name because that's the local population they're serving. I mean, there's a huge population of Central Americans in LA. So then, you know, and in New York, at Hunter College, it's still called the Puerto Rican Studies Program. So all of these things have very local and regional variations. I mean, I think a place like Northwestern, more even what the name Latino signals at a place like Northwestern has less to do with, you know, the kind of school that Northwestern is than it does the region where it's located. I mean, Chicago's Latino population is incredibly diverse. It's mm-hmm. Mexican-American, Puerto Rican, Cuban, Ecuadorian, Guatemalan. And I do think that, you know, the broader the group of Latinos you're talking about, the more likely they would be to come together around a term like Latino.
That's fascinating. Everything from Central America to Puerto Rican studies. So let's get to the meaty question, which I'm sure people are looking for in the title here. This is the worst pivot I've ever made in my life, but I'll keep going with it.
We can do it.
And this is what I was referencing at the start of the episode when I said there's been a lot of like conventional wisdom. It's like really rapidly shifting around like how Latino voters are actually thinking. Despite mm-hmm. everything from 2015 to 2020, according to some polls, Trump, you know, increased his percentage of the Hispanic vote by 10 points. Mm-hmm. On the face of it, that seems counterintuitive and crazy. What's happening?
There's so much to say. And, you know, I've been talking about this now for 2 years, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. I think there's a lot I am increasingly confident in saying, and there are still questions I have. I mean, the biggest lingering question is what it means for the future. I mean, we know what happened in 2020, and I do think analysts, even those who are the kind of Democratic advocates and political party consultants, are increasingly comfortable saying that there has been a shift, that something changed between 2016 and 2020. Even that point was not readily admitted the day after the election on 2020. Mm-hmm. You know, the emphasis was on how Latinos actually helped Joe Biden win the White House by delivering states like Arizona for the first time in a long time. So that was the narrative by Democratic strategists, political consultants, pollsters, right out of the election. And there was a lot of doubt cast over whether the shift was real, whether it actually happened, what we were seeing. I do think we are increasingly comfortable saying that a shift did happen. It is real. The movement is real. And frankly, I mean, every kind of opinion poll taken since the election confirms that there's something going on. And, you know, I think a lot of people have also looked to things like the special election in Virginia and New Jersey and Gavin Newsom's recall in California as kind of signs since 2020 about, you know, what's going on among Latinos. And so the shift is real. And I'll just start there. But about the Trump presidency from 2016 to 2020, I think, you know, watching how Trump approached Latinos is kind of like watching television on a split screen, because you do have all of the public pronouncements about Mexican rapists, murderers, and thieves that make it sound like that those are the kinds of statements that make it seem like it's unimaginable that Latinos would support Trump. And those were the real public pronouncements. There was also the, you know, incident in the Rose Garden at the White House where the CEO of Goya Beans praised Trump and then got slammed for praising Trump and saying that we were lucky to have Donald Trump as president. But I think to take that as an example, something the media missed that is really important to Latinos is that what that whole event at the White House was about was support for charter schools, support for small business owners and giving them loans. So the media got obsessed with this Goya Bean story and totally missed what the event was actually about, which was the announcement of support for charter schools, religious liberty, and small business owners. And I think that's indicative, the fact that, you know, the media got obsessed with one thing, even though the event was about something else, that's indicative of this split screen reality, because at the same time that Trump was making all these public pronouncements about rapists, murderers, and thieves, from the day he set foot in office, he or Mike Pence were giving speeches before Latino business communities, talking about slashing financial regulations, cutting taxes, making it easier to get small business loans, his support for charter schools with religious identities. He also was a kind of frequent guest at evangelical churches with a lot of Latinos in Florida or Arizona. And, you know, I think the Trump administration knew that Trump himself wasn't necessarily the best messenger to deliver, you know, messages about morality and church going and faith and things like that. So Mike Pence and even Mike Pence's relatives, I can't remember his name, but he had a nephew who was really active in the Latino outreach operation because he had spent time in Latin America, knew Spanish, things like that. So the point is, there was the split screen with the public pronouncements, but then all of the kind of on the ground things the Trump campaign and his Latino surrogates were doing for his whole 4 years in office to really reach out to Latinos. And you shouldn't forget that, like, I think it was in 2015 or 2016, at the same time that Trump said, I think in Detroit, that he was going to win the African-American vote, he also said that he was going to win the Latino vote in 2015. So even before he became a candidate officially, or maybe right after he became a candidate, he believed that he was going to win the Latino vote. And so that's what he set out to do.
I think something that's interesting here is that in terms of like discourse, especially with outsiders, you tend to lump Hispanic voters in with Black voters, with Asian voters. And something you just point out, you know, right off the bat, you know, with your writing, especially the Hispanic Republican, is that like a quarter to a third yeah. of, you know, Hispanics have voted Republican since like, you know, 70s. That's obviously very different than the Black community. So can you kind of, you know, obviously like you're not studying, you know, Black people, but could you basically talk about how a person of color, like voting experience has been like wrapped together when actually there's very clear, if you look at these numbers, it's very different.
Totally. And what was really interesting to me to learn as a historian is that these two things were happening at the exact same time, the declining support for the Republican Party by African-Americans was going down at the same time that support for Republicans was going up among Latinos, and for intertwined reasons. And a lot of it stemmed from the 1964 presidential campaign, when Barry Goldwater very famously took a stand against the Civil Rights Act. And even though African Americans since the Civil War and Reconstruction era were strongly identified as Republicans, as soon as Barry Goldwater, I mean, the support for Republicans had been going down a little bit ever since the New Deal, because many African Americans also supported Franklin Roosevelt for all of the New Deal programs, putting food on the table, giving them jobs, those sorts of things. So that's when the Democratic Party started to break into the African American community and start winning African American, greater numbers of African American support. But many African Americans remained Republicans into the 1960s until Barry Goldwater didn't support civil rights. And that, you know, ever since then, that was when like Goldwater and Nixon embraced what's known as the Southern strategy to try to, like, you know, appeal to Dixiecrats to flip white Democrats in the South to become Republicans. And that came at a cost for the Republican Party, which was losing African American support. So at the same time, I mean, Nixon's campaign strategists in 68 are very explicit about this. They say, we are losing African American votes. We need to make up for that lost support from somewhere. And the prime targets, one of the prime targets was Latinos. And they came up with all sorts of rationale for why this was the case. I mean, they talked about how they needed to note that the Democratic Party supported African Americans, and that was the party for African American civil rights, whereas we support Latinos. And we believe that Latinos are kind of naturally conservative because they are anti-communist, they are religious, they have a strong work ethic, all of these things. But it's only in the late 1960s, early 1970s, when they're losing African-American support, that they begin to try to articulate these reasons for why it makes sense to go recruit Latinos. The other thing I'll say really quickly is that the Latino population is really growing quickly in the 1960s and 1970s. So I think both parties realize that they need to start reaching out to these new voters, especially as states like Florida, Texas, California become more important electorally. And those also happen to be the states with the largest numbers of Latinos living in them. So I think that's what explains it. And in some ways, you know, the fates of African Americans and Latinos has been pretty closely linked over the past 50 or 60 years in different ways. I don't mean, you know, there is one argument for solidarity and working in unison with one another because you're both kind of similarly discriminated against minoritized voting populations. So there's that kind of argument for solidarity. But as we saw after the George Floyd murder, you know, there were Puerto Rican store owners in Chicago beating up African Americans because they were maybe looters and were going to damage their business. You know, so there's been a lot of a strong history of conflict between African Americans and Latinos as well. And we're still kind of waiting to see where that story goes.
I want to make reference to the future point you made earlier. I'm wondering, is there a world where towards the end of this 21st century, we think of Hispanic Latino voters more like we think of Italians today? In the sense that, you know, you read any book about early 20th century America, even watch The Godfather, right? So that's mid 20th century. Italian Americans are not white, quote unquote. Same thing goes for, you know, Eastern Europeans, Jews, et cetera. Is there a world where America never becomes majority minority because Hispanics just over time by third, fourth, fifth generation are just thought of as white or self-conceptualize themselves as white?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it's possible that over time, Latinos will increasingly identify as American and will assimilate, but I don't know that it means that they will increasingly identify as white. And I understand, I've heard this idea a lot that, you know, Latinos are really just the next Germans, Italians, Irish. And I think what's meant by that is that European ethnic groups identified as ethnic Americans in the late 19th, early 20th century when they arrived. They were German Americans, Irish Americans, Italian Americans. They experienced discrimination in similar ways. They weren't necessarily seen as white. And then over the course of the 20th century, they became white. They became assimilated Americans. So I understand the reason for the comparison. The thing I don't like is that I wouldn't want to imply that Latino assimilation necessarily means assimilating as white. I think that Latinos are too internally diverse for that. I mean, there are Afro-Cubans, Afro-Puerto Ricans, Afro-Dominicanos, Afro-Mexicans, who when they move to the United States they negotiate their racial identity somewhere between Latino and African Americans. I mean, there's a famous case of what's it called? In the early 20th century, the founder of the largest collection of African American materials at the New York Public Library. I can't remember his name, but he was an Afro-Puerto Rican whose name was very much, a Latino name, but he changed his name to identify more with New York's African-American community. And so I think Afro-Latinos, for example, come to the United States and kind of negotiate their identity as somewhere between Latinidad and African-American. And then there are indigenous Mexicans who speak Zapotec and move to Oregon or the Pacific Northwest. So I don't know that they will ever identify as white and assimilate as whites. But I do think, you know, do all of them come to the United States with some hope and expectation that they can live a better life here than they did in their home countries, that this will be the country that gives them educational and economic opportunities, and therefore will they buy into some version of Americanness, and will they be proud and loyal Americans? I mean, I can see that happening. I just don't know that will mean thinking of themselves as whites in the same way that German, Irish, and Italians did.
You know, it's funny, as you're giving that answer, I realized that the flaw in the question is even me just referring to Germans, Greeks, Italians, because that's a specific country group. And with Jewish Americans, like that is a very specific.
Sorry, we can switch that over. My dog is going.
No worries.
Hey, Lulu. You know what? I just realized I forgot the dog walker is coming over to pick her up. So
no worries.
That's why she was barking. Maybe we can start that over. In the meantime, I was looking it up. I couldn't believe that Schomburg. Yeah, we're still recording, right? So I can get that out. It was the Schomburg Center for African American History Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. And the man's name was Arturo Schomburg, and he changed his name to Arthur Schomburg and stopped identifying with New York's kind of Afro-Puerto Rican community but identified less as an Afro-Puerto Rican and more as an African-American in New York over time. So it's complicated.
Yeah. And I think this gets to the flaw in the question, which is where I'm referring to German Americans and Italian Americans and Irish Americans, when that's not what's happening with Hispanics or Latinos. The better way to phrase the question would be, is there a world where Cuban Americans ever start conceiving themselves as white? Mm-hmm. Are Puerto Rican Americans always going to like that? That's more adjacent. And even that is just so different. And I think the other thing that comes to mind, I want to know what you think about this, is the difference between Italian Americans and other groups I listed is that, with the exception of the German Americans towards like the, you know, mid 19th century, Hispanics and Latinos actually will be the majority in a variety of places. So it won't be about defining yourself again. The reason why you would assimilate white is because white is the majority. When you say American, that means white. Right. So by definition, that's how you assimilate. But if you're talking about Texas or California, how is that basically playing out today now?
That's right. That's right. And I think part of what your question gets at is that, in a fundamental way, I think what it means to assimilate into the United States in the early 20th century means something very different than what it means to assimilate into the United States in the mid 21st century, because it's a very different country. You know, many Latinos, I mean, Latinos are still legally defined as white. You know, ever since the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, which granted Mexican Americans citizenship, Mexican Americans have been legally categorized as white, because in 1848, when Mexican Americans were offered citizenship, the only people who could be citizens of the United States, according to the 1790 Naturalization Act, were white people. And so it conferred legal whiteness on them. Now, historians, legal scholars, sociologists have always argued that, yes, they might have been legally white, but they were always treated as non-white people. And interestingly, you know, there have been court cases throughout the 20th century where Mexican Americans themselves have asserted identities other than white, because in California, for example, there were anti-miscegenation laws saying that a Black person could not marry a white person. Well, there was a woman named, I can't remember her first name, but Perez, who wanted to marry an African-American man. She was not allowed to marry that African-American man. So she went to court to say that she is not a white person as a Mexican-American because she wanted to marry this person. And if it was a non-white Mexican marrying an African-American, that was legal. But if it was a white person marrying an African-American, it was illegal. So the whiteness of Latinos is a really contested topic as well. There have, of course, always been Latinos who identify as white. So that probably won't change. You know, the Latinos who identify as white today will continue to identify as white, I'm sure. But I'm not sure that Latinos broadly will come to think of themselves as white. I do think it's quite possible that Latinos will come to identify more and more as Americans, though.
Going back to the Trump thing, something I'm wondering about, like when you're talking about this Trump story, you're talking about charter schools, small business, entrepreneurship, right? Like the American dream stuff. Mm-hmm. Like that's been pretty consistent, like Jack Kemp style, like Republican rhetoric, right? You could find a vouchers packet from like the 1990s that would probably say similar things. Mm. Yeah. The question is like, why now? Mm. Right? Why? What's happening now?
That is super interesting. And it notes really important changes within the Republican Party. And as a historian, it's so interesting to me that it is since the 1970s that between a quarter and a third of Latinos have supported the Republican Party. And that has stayed fairly consistent across those 70 years. Sometimes it's a little less. Maybe it was around 20% that supported Gerald Ford and Bob Dole. Sometimes it's a little more, like with George W. Bush getting 44% of the Latino vote. So, but it's been pretty consistent within that 25 to 33% range, even as the Republican Party has shifted dramatically. I mean, it is no longer, Gerald Ford's party, George W. Bush's party, George H.W. Bush's party. And that's why when I talk to Latino conservatives, I mean, one simple answer to your question is that Latino conservatives have moved along with the party, you know, embraced Republican party policies, no matter what those policies are. I think about my grandpa. You know, my grandpa first became a Republican in 1980. He voted for Ronald Reagan for the first time. He was a copper miner in Arizona, and he voted for Reagan because he said that Reagan was going to put more money into his paycheck in the form of tax cuts. So it was that very particular issue. But he's still alive. He's 96, living in a VA home in Tucson. And he didn't vote in 2020, but he did vote for Trump in 2016. And when I've talked to him about why he supported Donald Trump, he said, Donald Trump is a good guy because he's a Republican. It wasn't any statement about his support for Trump's policies or anything. It was just because he was a Republican. So many Latino Republicans, I think, have just moved with the party. That said, when I was doing all of my interviews for my book, it was actually the older Latino Republicans were having trouble justifying their continued support for Trump's Republican Party. These were Latinos who came into the Republican Party even during the Eisenhower years or the Nixon years or the Reagan years, and just felt like the Republican Party that they entered was no longer the Republican Party that existed today. So there's a guy named Leonel Sosa, an advertising executive in San Antonio, who worked on Reagan's Hispanic campaign. Before that, he worked on John Tower, the Texas Senator, John Tower's Senate campaign. And he very publicly in 2016, like, wrote op-eds in the San Antonio Express News saying, I'm out. I can't do it anymore. You know, this Donald Trump is not a conservative. He's a showman. He's all of these other things, but he's not a conservative. So he announced publicly that he was going to vote for Hillary Clinton, First time he voted for a Democrat in 60, 70 years. But Trump's percentage of support still went up, which to me signals that he not only consolidated support among many Latino conservatives who felt like they didn't have anywhere else to go. Even if their party was changing, they were still going to vote for Republicans because that's how they'd voted their whole lives. But I think he also had to have energized a whole new group of Latino voters, first-time voters, youth voters, voters in college. And so I think about, there's a guy in Texas, for example, named Abraham Enriquez, who started a group called Bienvenido US. It's affiliated with Charlie Kirk's Turning Point USA. He runs his own podcast. He's like 24, 25, a real Texan conservative, and he's a young guy. And his mission is to recruit Latino youth to the Republican Party. So, you know, Trump galvanized a lot of younger Latinos as well. So that's, I think, part of how things are changing.
To what degree is this then about Trump and his specific working class cross-racial appeal versus just like the Republican Party, right? So I can't see us having this same conversation if Mitt Romney were president or Mitt Romney had run in 2016. So like the real question here then is, whenever Trump does leave the stage, will whoever inherits the Republican Party bring these same potential avenues? Or is this really just dated to Trump's ability to stand above everything in the American political system, for good or for ill?
You know, this is $1 million question. I feel like with inflation, it's probably $1 billion question, you know? because I feel like we've been debating for many, many years whether Trump is driving the train or whether there were kind of subterranean political shifts happening in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s that led to Trump. I mean, one explanation could be demographic change. The color of the United States has been changing for 40, 50 years. We thought with Barack Obama's election that that represented the kind of ultimate victory of the civil rights movement of the 60s and 70s, that we could elect our first Black president. And I think that that gave a lot of liberals comfort that they had won, you know? But all along, bubbling under the surface, there was white grievance politics all the time. There was a raid in Ruby Ridge or a raid in Waco that was about separatism in some ways, but it was about libertarianism in some ways, but it was also about whiteness. There was like the Ku Klux Klan patrolling the US-Mexico border to halt Mexican immigration in the late 1970s, early 1980s. This is what David Duke was up to in the late 70s and early 80s. So there was like Trumpism before Trump. And this is why like Patrick Buchanan, for example, waged a very successful primary campaign against George H.W. Bush in 1992. He tapped into a lot of the nativism and xenophobia and things like that. So, you know, I think we're really debating whether Trump was driving the train with all these political changes or whether he was just tapping into a broader dissatisfaction that erupted in 2016. I do think that now that the genie's out of the bottle, it's going to be harder to put it back in. You know, I mean, I don't think Trumpism will go away. I think you see a lot of Trumpism in the Latina candidates running for Congress in South Texas right now with Myra Flores and Monica de la Cruz and Cassie Garcia. I mean, a lot of people have talked about how they are saying the same things as Donald Trump and supporting Donald Trump's policies on immigration and everything else, but are very different messengers than Donald Trump. And so, you know, it's a weird moment. I mean, this is called the realignment, this podcast. And I think we're in the middle of something happening, but I don't know how the story is going to end. You know, I really don't, because, you know, we'll see if, it seems like Trump's endorsement, the role that Trump is playing in national politics right now ahead of the midterms, it's kind of mixed. I mean, a lot of his primary candidates are winning, but they might lose the general, you know? So we'll see.
What's weird to me here is, and once again, this really comes down to like when you were when you graduate from college, because I was interning on the Hill in 2013. So right after the Romney loss. And at the time, that was when President Obama was giving his last push for immigration reform. And you had a whole section of the Republican Party that would surprise people today, Sean Hannity, et cetera, saying we need to support immigration reform, because the only way the Republican Party can survive is if we appeal to Hispanic voters more. And the way to appeal to Hispanic voters more is by pathway to citizenship, amnesty, pick your euphemism, body, blah. And that gets, that's a whole other set of controversies. But it seems like Republicans have started to find their way through. How should we think about the role that immigration plays on the issue ranking?
Because here's the thing, too. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Because like the quick thing here, too, is, and this is why George W. Bush getting to 40% is so important. You don't need to win Hispanics outright, but a Republican Party that could consistently get 40% of Hispanics in a variety of states, it's over for Democrats electorally. Mm-hmm. So help me understand that.
Yeah, I think Democrats feel that too. I mean, the number I hear them throw out is like, you know, they've got to keep winning at least 2/3 of the Latino vote if they get closer
to
60-40
split. That's pretty tight.
It's pretty tight. Yeah. It's pretty tight. But they think that if they get closer to a 60-40 split, it's a real problem. You know what's really interesting? I mean, you're identifying so many interesting things. One thing that is fascinating to me is how quickly the Republican Party turned between 2012 and 2016. I mean, it felt like it turned on a dime, like where, you have the election postmortem in 2013, 1 year calling for like a big tent Republican Party in 2012. And then 4 years later, you have a Republican Party that's all about, you know, white grievance and xenophobia, at least in terms of, you know, its candidate. I'm not trying to paint the same brush the whole Republican Party. It's as internally diverse and complicated as Republicans, as Democrats, I'm sure. But there's no doubt that the primary voters kind of threw their lot in with Donald Trump. And what's
one quick thing that relates to this, and this is fascinating too, which is 2012, don't forget, Mitt Romney, self-deportation.
Yes.
And Rick Perry, who seemed like he was in great position, is partially torpedoed over him defending in-state tuition for undocumented immigrants. So even that's a case where you had the big thing, I think, this conversation is there are these weird things bubbling. And I think even those two incidents really showed you that 2013 consensus was not a sustainable consensus. But sorry, go on.
No, it wasn't. And you also had, you know, John McCain running for president in 2008, but then running for Senate again in 2010, running campaigns to say, like, build the dang fence. You know, he was all about building
about
a border wall.
Jeez.
In 2010, you had Herman Cain calling for an electric fence, an electric fence and alligator moats and stuff like that. I mean, another thing that's going on that is hard to forget is 9/11 happens, and it's really before 9/11, I mean, I've had the chance to meet with Vicente Fox, the former Mexican president. He's told me that the week before 9/11, he was at the White House working with George W. Bush on a comprehensive immigration package. They really wanted to get it done. Bush entered office months before with that as a priority. But the conversation changed after 9/11 in lots of ways. I mean, that's when in 2006, there was a Secure Fence Act. Part of the Secure Fence Act was, you know, there's this widespread fear of Muslim terrorists crossing the U.S.-Mexico border carrying missiles. I don't know that there was any proof or evidence for that, but that was a fear. And so very quickly, like, anti-immigrant sentiment swept across the nation. So I think, you know, that also helps explain why the Republican Party was like wrestling with immigration at that moment and trying to strike a balance, even if they haven't done so successfully, between border control and restriction and, pro-immigration sentiment. So, you know, what's interesting is I talked to Latino conservatives today. These are people who worked in George W. Bush's White House. They were all about comprehensive immigration reform. Some of them opposed Trump in 2016. They have since come to support Trump. And what some of them have told me is now they're comfortable saying that what Trump showed is that the Republican path to victory with Latino support doesn't necessarily run through immigration reform. Mm-hmm. They even say that the George W. Bush theory of the case that you had to do comprehensive immigration was kowtowing to Democrats. And it was basically embracing the Democratic theory of the case. It was like Republican light is what they called it. It was like Republicans trying to behave like Democrats. And what they like about Trump is that he embraced truly conservative ideologies. And in many ways, you know, despite this guy, Leonel Sosa, saying that Trump isn't a true conservative, many Latino conservatives have actually compared Trump more to Reagan than to George W. Bush and said that, you know, like Reagan, Trump is a kind of conservative ideologue. He's anti-socialist, pro-business, all of these things. So that's interesting to me, that to think that A, Trump is kind of going to become the second coming of George W. Bush, you know, the Republican most responsible in the past 30 or 40 years for really bringing Republicans into the party. No one would have thought that he was going to be the second coming of George W. Bush, and that Trump would be compared more closely to Ronald Reagan. I mean, that's interesting. There are key differences between Reagan and Trump, of course. I mean, Reagan still passed the Immigration Reform and Control Act with amnesty for millions of Mexicans, and always said that we don't need a border wall between the United States and Mexico, and saw Mexico as a real ally. So there are key differences, but on the point of kind of conservative ideology, they're more likely to compare Trump to Reagan than Bush.
The thing I want to wrap with is, where does this leave Democrats and or comprehensive immigration reform activists? Because this really, that's why I was focusing on the 2013 point, because the 2013 point was, you have to do this because we're going to win, because the country is going to get browner. Mm-hmm. But now if you're a Republican, you're like, actually, we don't. We could talk about socialism. We can talk about small business like stuff. There's definitely going to be a COVID hangover there. Like, where does this leave Democrats?
Yeah, that's a good question. I also think it's fair to ask where it leaves Republicans and thinking about their long-term future too, and how they're going to kind of build on Latino support in 2020. And kind of, I mean, my personal belief is that before Republicans get too excited about how they did in 2020, they need to remember that, you know, consistently winning between a quarter and a third of the Latino vote, which is continuing to grow, I don't think that's a recipe for long-term success. I mean, looking 20, 30, 40 years into the future, just continually win. Why would you be happy with just 25 to 33% of a group that will be increasingly important? So I think Republicans have a lot to work on too. And they also have said that, Marco Rubio and others have said, like, well, you know, the Republican Party is becoming a multiracial working class party. That's a good statement. It hasn't been that. And I think the Republican Party also has work to do to make that statement a reality. So that's the Republican side. I think the Democrats, this is my opinion. I am not a pollster. I'm a historian. I'm much more comfortable talking about the past than the present. So this is my, I think it's a little more than a hot take, but it's not quite like solid quote me on this. But my opinion is that, and I'm not working in that political world where I'm running a campaign, constantly conducting opinion surveys, but my observation is that I do think the Democratic Party is, you know, trying to figure out how to retool a bit, because they have been operating largely with this theory that it was about comprehensive immigration reform, bringing in new young people to the party. Latinos are overwhelmingly young, and thousands are become eligible to vote every month. And so a lot of it relied on comprehensive immigration reform. One thing I hear Democratic activists and strategists talking about today is how immigration is also an economic issue, because it's about jobs. It's also a healthcare issue, because it's about getting healthcare for them. It's also about education, because it's about schooling for their kids. And so I think they're still thinking a lot about immigration, but trying to make the argument that immigration is also much broader than just immigration, because it touches on all of these other aspects of American life. But I also think that the Democratic Party does really have to wrestle with how it is going about recruiting the support of workers and working class voters. It is possible, I think. I think this because you can look at the Rio Grande Valley and say that, you know, working class voters really did move toward Donald Trump in 2020. And so I think, you know, both in terms of how they talk about it, but also policies, Democrats are, I think, figuring out how to retool and be more representative of working class Americans.
That is an excellent place to end it. Gerardo, we'd love for you to just shout out the book. It's available in our bookshop. Can't recommend it enough.
Thank you so much, Marshall. It was nice to talk to you, and keep in touch.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.